For this and all Clinical Updates podcasts, a 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit will be available for a limited time. To claim credit, view the slide deck associated with this podcast and complete the evaluation found in the slides. Speakers, planners, and CME staff do not have any relevant financial relationships with ineligible companies to disclose.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Clinical Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Johnny Steffens, who's a certified nurse midwife who works in Center Care in Menopause and Sexual Medicine. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Thank you. So today we are going to be talking about genitourinary syndrome of menopause, which I just learned is also known as, many terms I still use, and I'm in the wrong apparently, correct? Vaginal atrophy is one of them.
No longer used.
Why not? Is it wrong, or they don't encompass the condition as it should?
So this condition was renamed in 2014. Previously, we were using vulvovaginal atrophy, atrophic vaginitis, sometimes just saying vaginal dryness. Those are describing one symptom, one clinical exam finding, and does not take into account the breadth of the condition. So okay. Renamed as genitourinary syndrome of menopause, or GSM actually is how we call it.
GSM, clear.
GSM.
Which is defined as?
So GSM is a state of estrogen and testosterone deficiency. It's a chronic condition that progressively worsens with time and age. It affects the vulva, the vagina, the lower urinary tract, the pelvic floor, and sexual functioning. As is in the name, this is typically associated with perimenopause and menopause women. But I also remind providers that a very similar state of this hormone deficiency can occur in other aspects of a woman's life, including during lactation, during cancer treatments, in cases of young hypogonadism, primary ovarian insufficiency. And it also happens with medications like oral contraceptives and spironolactone.
Interesting. So incidentally, I don't want to miss that part. So do you see this problem in younger women or premenopausal women, especially if they are many years before menopause and they are on contraceptives, you see this already being an issue?
Yep, you can definitely see it in the younger population, certainly not as, pronounced as I see it in our over 50 group, because after that, pretty much all of us are going to have it if we live long enough. But in those other groups, a lot of times postpartum, women are breastfeeding, their oral contraceptive, long-term use, you will see it there. They usually present with a dyspareunia or sexual pain or vulvar symptoms, but their symptoms, the physical exam findings are all very consistent with each other. We treat it exactly the same way. Okay. It's just in those cases, it's not a permanent situation.
Great. I love that you said if you live long enough, because I had a question. Now, this that I'll say may be something very stupid, very ignorant, but it's great that I said in case somebody had that question. So I put myself out there. So this is something that it's a clear example. I could come up with the same concept in other parts of the body and certainly male, but in this case, without modern medicine and, you know, safe water and food and blah, 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 we perhaps were not meant to live this long without being eaten or killed or septic or something. So my question is, you go through menopause, you probably have 15 kids, you know, we are in the 1600s, and then you make it 30 more years. Would it be fair to say that even though this is a condition, is part of normal aging for a woman?
Well, I think in the 1600s, we didn't live 30 years after menopause.
Correct, yeah. So that's what I'm saying. We are prolonging our life beyond what we were, and I use this word carefully, designed or made for to live, correct?
Yeah, our ovaries have not caught up with that. So our ovaries are not living longer. They're still giving up the ghost at 52, but we are living a third of our life past that time. So we are going to see these, you know, hypoestrogen, hypoandrogenic conditions and the symptoms that result from them because we are living longer.
Okay, so that brings me to the question of, you know, again, with all my ignorance, but you have an unobstructed carotid and you put a stent, right? But this is such a complex balance of tissues. You lose the estrogens that are so finely balanced by nature. How recoverable is with giving medications while you're not doing that finesse that nature gave you? How treatable it is and how successfully treatable it is?
This is one of the low-hanging fruits in medicine. Treatment okay. is extremely effective. Women don't fail treatment.
Wow.
The problem is that it's under-recognized and it's under-treated. That's where the issues are. So when we can use the gold standard treatment, which is vaginal hormones, we are supporting the vulvar, the vaginal, and the bladder tissues.
How you do that if you are not applying it on the bladder? How does that work?
We have estrogen receptors everywhere. And our vagina is our gatekeeper to bladder infections.
So they're not getting into the bladder. It's just...
Nope.
Okay, nope. Okay. Yeah, fascinating. So tell me about the topical estrogen, right, we are getting into.
Sure. So there are 5 medications that we use to treat GSM. 4 of them are vaginal inserted, administered products. Mm-hmm. Most providers are going to be familiar with estrogen creams, mm-hmm. which either come in Premarin or Estrace. Those creams are measured into an applicator. They're inserted into the vagina. Pretty easy, straightforward to use. They are generally inexpensive medications covered by insurances. And if you are dosing them correctly and you are using the correct route of administration, you're going to get 75 to 80% improvement by 12 weeks of their vulvar symptoms, which is, yes, dryness, but itching, burning, irritation. They have pain with sex and their bladder symptoms. Their frequency, their urgency, their dysuria, their incontinence, and you're going to get a 50% reduction in their UTIs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So, do you feel sometimes that you're screaming in a room saying, "Use topical estrogen, it works," and we just don't?
Yeah.
Why is that? Is this the concern about cancer and all that? Talk to me a little bit about that.
I think it's minimizing the condition because we, for years have called it vaginal dryness. Well, nobody's ever died of vaginal dryness. Mm-hmm. You know, get over it. You know, get some lube, have a glass of wine. You're going to be fine. Sorry. And providers were not connecting the dots to bladder health.
Yeah.
To be perfectly honest, which is much more significant. I mean, these are significant, not only quality of life issues, but potentially life-threatening with something like urosepsis. Yeah.
When you say bladder, is there truly an effect on the bladder? Is just everything before the bladder strengthening the urethra and the vaginal tissue to prevent bladder issues? Or does something change
in
the bladder
I would say
wall?
What you're describing there, we're kind of fixing the downstream effects, which is going to relieve their symptoms. And we are improving the vaginal microbiome so it has good bacteria again. It's acidic. It's killing off the GI bugs that are setting up camp and wanting to jump into our bladder and cause an infection. That's okay. Really kind of how that works.
Okay. So why we don't do it? So, okay, we take it as normal aging. Like you said, I presume you drink the glass of wine and all that. But I hear, and again, remember, I didn't turn amazing well over a decade ago. But what happened with all these concerns about cancers, history of cancer? Could it increase cancer? What's the up to date on that?
So I would tell you that diagnosing GSM is simple.
Okay.
You just need to know, you need to be asking about symptoms and you need to do a good vulvar exam. Mm-hmm.
Which in your slides, by the way, they're pretty clear.
Very detailed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Treating GSM is very easy. I mean, we're talking 5 medications. This is not hypertension or diabetes where we have this, huge selection of medications. You learn. Mm-hmm. Really, you can learn 4 meds and you're good to go. The difficulty is that there is so much misinformation that we have to untangle around the safety of vaginal estrogens, that is where the provider's time takes in. And I do believe that providers are, at least in some cases, worried about you know, we providers get the same misinformation as everybody else.
Sure.
And unless you do this all the time, you may not have kept up to date in the last 20 years since the WHI study was released and hormone use was significantly.
What is WHI study?
So WHI is the Women's Health Initiative. It was the largest study on women's health, particularly in menopause, launched in the late 1990s. One of the arms was terminated early because of a suspected increase in breast cancer.
So that's probably what stained the field.
It is. You know, and if people aren't really familiar to what WHI was looking at, number one, I tell people all the time, that wasn't on vaginal estrogen. We have absolutely no scientific data that vaginal estrogens cause cardiovascular events, blood clots. Nobody's getting cancer. Nobody's getting a reoccurrence of cancer. And women are not dying because they use vaginal estrogen. Women, however, do die of UTIs.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So, okay, let's further untangle this in the following way. What are contraindications to using estrogen?
None.
Okay. Well, that's pretty easy. Thank you for coming. Have a good day. Now,
and no drug interactions. So no contraindications, no drug interactions.
Obviously. That is, I feel so ignorant. This is great. Now, what if you have history of vaginal cancer? The etiology is different, right? Because it's a squamous cancer, so it wouldn't be through the estrogens, correct? So.
Right.
That's
so
getting picky for no reason.
It is getting picky for no reason. And even in the cases of hormone sensitive breast cancers, ovarian, endometrial, those are where you see the concerns, you know, mm-hmm. kind of cancers around. People need to understand that these medications are very low dose. It is not raising your estrogen levels in your circulating system.
Yeah, that was my question.
System.
Laboratory evidence that you don't have an increased blood concentration.
There is.
It doesn't spill over in the blood.
Yep, there are studies. So you are not going to raise anybody's estrogen level out of a postmenopausal range. They work locally, so we're only going to see the effects on the vulva, the vagina, and the bladder. They are basically microdosing these medications. And so that is why the data is really not there, that we're going to see a reoccurrence of a hormone-sensitive cancer, whether it's breast, ovarian, or endometrial, in that population. And there are now, especially since WHI, you know, over 20 years ago, it has not only been reanalyzed, but there is a lot more data around that. So generally, I see a lot of breast cancer patients, in particular, oncology refers them to me, and I do manage them with vaginal hormones, mostly because they're going to experience this condition sooner, younger, and more severe because of their cancer treatments.
So it's a disservice to your patient not to give topical estrogen when they have GSM.
I think so. I think providers should not only be treating people, but we should certainly be promoting prevention. I would like to see every woman at 45 on vaginal hormones.
Yeah, so that was my next question. So before we get into that, like putting statins in the water, you know, let's put estrogen in the water kind of thing. Well, but my question was, what percentage of women at some point, if they live to 90, let's say, are going to have GSM?
Nearly 100%.
So it's...
It's a given.
It will happen. Okay.
Mm-hmm. My oldest patient's 104.
What's that? The oldest patient?
My oldest patient's 104. Yeah.
And she goes to the office?
She did, yeah.
Okay.
Well, and older women are typically going to present with the reoccurrent UTIs. That's how they come in.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fascinating. Okay, so it occurs on pretty much everybody. So in that context, is that you would say if it was you were the director of HHS, you would say every woman over 45 should get this or get offered this, period.
It should be available to them. You know, at the end of the day, women get to choose. I tell them I'm not the estrogen police. I want them to have the correct information. not only about what the medications, what GSM, you know, symptoms are like, because women don't recognize that sometimes, but also what the medications do, the safety of those medications. And once women are armed with that information, they are totally capable to make those decisions for themselves. But I think we need to be having those conversations. And I certainly do in my perimenopausal patients.
Okay. So the just to backtrack a little more, We talked about diagnosis and how it looks, and of course there are pictures and in the slides, and probably most practitioners are familiar with this. Is there any way to? There's no video here, but you're not in your head, so I haven't served the truth with that. Not most practitioners are familiar with this.
With the physical findings, I would say that's true.
So they call it aging. Or they just don't see it, or what?
Or they might just identify it based on a patient's symptoms, which you can do. I mean, if a patient who's postmenopausal presents with one of these symptoms of GSM, you can make the diagnosis and you can treat that. I feel like physical exams are extremely important, especially after the age of 50, because women are not getting routine gynecological care anymore. They may be past the age where we're doing cervical cancer screening or not doing pelvic exams, and that's has transcended into we're not looking at genitals. So I would say, unless you're a gynecologist who is looking at vulvas all day, you may not know what a vulva with GSM looks like. And that's why I included pictures, because it's striking. As one conference presenter said one time, the vulva is the small Midwestern town that everybody drives through, but nobody stops. I also think providers are not trained how to do a very comprehensive vulvar exam, because we are just interested in getting into the vagina and doing their pap smear or doing their pelvic exams. So I would say the majority of providers have not really looked at a lot of vulvas comprehensively. They're not looking at clitorises. They're not looking for adhesions. They, you know, urology certainly is looking at urethras. And I would say urologists are some of the best people to identify this condition, because they are doing exams.
The last point I wanted to touch on is there are estrogen creams and inserts, and can you give me a one plus and minus for each formulation?
I can. So I will tell you that even though most people are familiar mostly with the cream, they may not be as aware of the other options. I don't prescribe the cream as often. My number one prescription that goes out my office multiple times in a day is estradiol vaginal inserts. So inserts are essentially exactly like the cream, but instead of in a cream formulation, they're in a tablet. They're in a single-use pre-filled applicator. You just take the applicator out of the package, insert it into the vagina, push the plunger, and it pops the tablet in there. So there's no measuring of a cream. Women are not trying to clean that applicator, because if you look at the data, the cream is the least likely to be compliant with. And that is because women find it messy and goopy and annoying. And if that's how you feel about your medication regimen, you're not going to use it consistently. You're not going to use it as often, and you're not going to use it as much. And so I love the vaginal inserts. They are now generic. They are pretty well covered by insurance. And there are also some really good cost savings that you can get to get copays down if they still seem to be expensive. So that is kind of my go-to. It's also easier for my older women, my women in long-term care. It's easier for caregivers to do the inserts compared to the cream. But there is also other options. So besides the cream and the inserts, we have the low-dose vaginal ring. It is placed inside the vagina. It stays there for 90 days. It just then needs to be replaced. That can be done most often by the patient themselves. It's pretty easy to do. But I do have patients who have mobility or cognitive deficits. And so they come in and see me every 3 months, and I just replace their ring. It's otherwise very hands-off. Then I can be really, you know, confident that they're getting an adequate dose of their medication. There is prasterone, which is the vaginal suppository, so a little bit different in, you know, formulation. It is actually not estrogen. It is DHEA, which we need to have DHEA made in our bodies. So our bodies make estrogen and testosterone. So prasterone works like estrogen and testosterone on all of those tissues. And then the final product, which is not first line, it's the second line option, is osfemipine. That is the only oral option. It is not estrogen either. It's a SERM, but it works like estrogen on those tissues. The downside to esfemapine is that it does have contraindications. There are women who cannot use it, where, as we talked about, the vaginal hormones don't have any. And there might be more side effects than you would really ever see with the vaginal products. But most of the time, what we're doing the inserts, we're doing the ring, and when patients can afford it, we will do Prasterone as well. I prescribe all of them.
Fantastic.
They all work equally well.
And that's a wrap up. Thank you so much, Tony.
Thank you.